You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times, hopefully. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me a really good friend, John Rubino. And John, of course, most of you would know John from his frequent appearances on this show, but he is also he also heads up dollarcollapse.com. And you really need to go to that website. I mean, I went there this morning. I don't go every day, but this morning in preparation for our discussion, I went there. And every week he puts up videos. I guess this is top 10, but I think sometimes there's more than 10. If you really want to keep up with some of the most significant names among the hard money camp anyway, for example, there's videos up this week, Rick Rule, Michael Pinto, Jim Rickards, Peter Schiff, David McIlvaney, Raoul Powell, and more, and very, very good ones. And so I would say to go there as well as to read John's articles and others that he posts there. It'd be well worth your time if you're really a serious student of the markets. Thanks for joining me again, John.
Hey, Jay. It's great to be back.
It's always good to have you here. You're over there across the Rockies, up there in the Northwest, and some secluded area, supposedly, and far away from all the COVID people dancing around the streets of Seattle, I guess.
Well, it could be a little more secluded from my point of view. We're not that far from Seattle, and I would like to be a lot farther based on what's going on over there.
Yeah, but you do. But I mean, you do have to sort of. It's not so easy to get from Seattle to where you live, I think. So
yeah, thank God that it's a hard trip. You have to put your car on a ferry to drive across, and you know, that would slow down the whole giant protest. Yeah. Caravans and everything, right? So yeah, hopefully hopefully it doesn't come to that. You know, maybe we're basically done with the whole civil unrest thing for this cycle until after the election. I think we're going to go back into it.
That's what I'm afraid of. But John, the least important election of our time, you wrote, and that's the article that's posted at Dollar Collapse. So folks, you can go read that. But John will tell us some of what's in there now. You know, as you start out, you say a consensus seems to have formed on both left and right that the upcoming presidential election involves some literally existential questions, making it the most important election of our lifetimes. In fact, the opposite is true, you say. This election is the least important of the past 30 years and very possibly the least important ever. Because to put it bluntly, we're kind of screwed either way. So let's consider some of those supposedly existential threats, and then you name a bunch of them. You start out with a politicized Supreme Court. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I mean that is one of the major issues of this election. Mm-hmm. But in a system that's rapidly going bankrupt, it's not really going to matter all that much whether, for instance, Obamacare gets repealed. And actually, the only issue on Obamacare that's before the Supreme Court is just this one little thing called the mandate, where the government can force you to buy insurance.
Right.
And that's clearly unconstitutional. The government does not have the power. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say the government is allowed to tell us what to buy. So that should be... That shouldn't pass muster of the Supreme Court. It should be knocked out of Obamacare. But you know what? Obamacare would just go on as before, minus the mandate. So that's not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
And in any event, you know, if that accelerated the move to Medicare for all, then from a liberal standpoint, it's actually progress, you know, even though it might not seem like it at first. Mm-hmm. Not progress for you and me, but progress for people who would like to see total government-run healthcare. And then abortion is another one, where Roe versus Wade is clearly a bad decision because, you know, in 1973, the Supreme Court wanted abortion to be legal and so just made up a right in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. You know, they said the Constitution implies that because there's a right to privacy, you know, abortion is a private thing, therefore abortion cannot be made illegal in any state. That could easily be overturned by a conservative court. And that has the, you know, the left is just freaked by that prospect. But if it happened, most states would just turn around and make abortion legal, you know, and then they would figure out a way to ferry women from the pro-life states. And so there would still be abortion. And, you know, Roe versus Wade would not end abortion. It would just put it back into the legislative realm where it should have been all along. You know, we as voters get to decide about this thing. So, you know, a Supreme Court that goes conservative from here wouldn't actually change the world in any huge fundamental way. And if it leads the Democrats after the election, when they, you know, assuming they take power this time around, to then try to pack the court, then that opens up a whole new political battle, which will probably go against the guys who are trying to pack the court, right? That seems like a really unpopular thing to do. So, you know, this battle over this Supreme Court nominee and what happens afterwards has nothing to do with the fact that we're going bankrupt. And that's the overriding fact, you know, and a lot of these other, especially the social issues, you know, they're very important. I don't want to minimize the validity of points of view on social issues, but, you know, battling over them now is like trying, you know, battling over renovating the kitchen while your house is burning down. You know, the big thing that's happening will make all of this stuff seem kind of quaint in retrospect, because we are headed for a financial crisis that is going to be epic. You know, it'll be unlike anything certainly that we've seen in our lifetimes, and, you know, very possibly like we've seen ever, because we're corrupting fiat currencies all around the world. This isn't a one country thing. This is a global hyperinflation / currency crisis that's coming our way. And so I'm frankly kind of exhausted by the political battles that don't involve debt, because, you know, if we then go on to debt as an issue in this election, well, we were running $1 trillion deficits before this election under the Republicans, supposedly the small government party, and we'll be running $1 trillion deficits after the election, regardless of who wins. That's, you know, so right. we are headed for that cliff at an accelerating rate, and this election will not affect it in any way. I mean, you know, we'll be spending money on different things depending on who's in charge, but we'll still be spending that money. We will still be using negative interest rates to encourage the private sector to take on unreasonable amounts of debt, because that's how you generate, you know, what little tax revenue that governments do get these days. You get people to buy houses and cars and things like that and pay sales taxes and et cetera, et cetera.
I see what you mean. I definitely buy that part of it, but I'm not quite sure, John, that I would agree with regard to the insignificance of this election for a couple of reasons. Let's say that the Democrats take the Senate, assume they keep the House, I more or less do, but they have a good chance of taking the Senate, and they win the White House, and they decide that they're going to get rid of the Electoral College. Does that have to go through would that have to be an amendment? I'm not sure. But if they're talking about, they want to get rid of the Electoral College, they want to get rid of the filibuster in the Senate, they're talking about adding two more liberal states so they'd get four more senators, they're talking about packing the courts. Now, that one I sort of agree with you on, because you said it's not popular. And I did see a statistic at lunchtime today that I think it was like 60% of Democrats think it's a bad idea. So if that's the case, then maybe that doesn't get done. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But what I fear is that we have a one-party rule. Already the Democrats seem not to be interested in freedom of speech. Any college campus that's dominated by liberals will not allow conservatives to speak. We've seen what has just happened with the strongly the IT companies, the big social media companies, Twitter and Facebook, that are silencing reports from the New York Post regarding the Biden family and what's going on there. You could shut down the First Amendment. The Second Amendment, the Democrats are hostile towards, generally, at least the ones on the left, the furthest to the left, are hostile towards both the First and Second Amendments. And John, if we lose those amendments, I mean, I don't know that they can, but they're doing it. I mean, they're trying to take away the Second Amendment through legislation, through the states, and so forth. So I definitely agree with you on the issue of the economy, that we are in trouble no matter who is president. But it seems to me that on the margin, there may be some differences. For example, if you have a Supreme Court, that really are made up of strict constructionists, and they're not trying to make legislation, as you just pointed out, they did in Roe v. Wade. But you had someone that tried to stick to the rules, to the laws, to the Constitution. It might make a difference. But on the other hand, I also believe that if you have a country made up of angry people who are hungry, can't put food on their tables, and can't pay their rents, and they're destitute, that probably it won't make a lot of difference. I kind of think that.
You know, I agree with everything that you just said about what the Democrats would do if they get into power. You know, it wouldn't be pretty.
Yeah.
We would end up with a one-party state because they would use demographics. They would weaponize demographics to get elected. But then we would have this one-party state presiding over an epic financial crisis, which, you know, they would get blamed for it.
Yeah. Well, and for that reason, it seems to me, a good friend of mine goes to the church I go to, is convinced that it's better. It would be better if, if the Democrats won the White House, but the Republicans kept the Senate. And maybe that kind of divided government might be better. I don't know. But you have – go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think you could make that case basically for the past 40 years that gridlock – is the best possible outcome for the U.S. government, right? Because the less they do, the less damage they do.
Yeah, so, that's what the founding fathers wanted. That's why they structured things the way they are. But that's what the Democrats are trying to get rid of. They're trying to get rid of these checks and balances that make dictatorship or one-party rule impossible or very difficult. And so I think that was the genius of our founding fathers to set these different checks and balances up. But if you have a Supreme Court that is nothing more than a legislature, then one of those three stools that balance the country, that keep us in check, are gone. You know, a two-legged stool isn't very stable.
Yeah. Well, we've already left behind most of the checks and balances that were originally in the Constitution. The biggest was sound money, right? You take that away.
Yeah.
And you get all of the stuff that we have right now very obviously. Like anybody who understands human nature would look at the 1971 decision to basically give every government in the world an unlimited checking account. And they would look at that and say, oh, that's probably a bad idea. I bet that corrupts everybody and we end up with way too much debt, and et cetera. And so we got that. You know, so that part of the Constitution is over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
money, the dollar is defined in terms of a set amount of gold and silver. So
yeah, it says that in the Constitution. And somehow they got around it. But you know, that's the tendency of government. It wants to get around limitations on its power. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think it's the Thomas Jefferson who said that periodically the tree of liberty has to be watered with the blood of tyrants, or tyrants and patriots. But basically, that's the battle that we have left our kids, right? They're going to have to confront a government that is completely out of control and that is doing things that weren't even contemplated as possible in the Constitution. And, you know, from the financial and political rubble of that, we're going to have to rebuild something that is viable. And that's really where the interesting argument comes. I think, you know, arguments today don't lead anywhere because we haven't had the crisis yet. And once we have that crisis, once we're in the depths of it, mm-hmm. and people are educating themselves about the nature of money, for instance, and the limitations of government and what are natural rights and what are, you know, entitlements that are granted by the government and how do those things differ? And, you know, we have that conversation and then we an idea forms, at least on one side of the spectrum, that we need to go back to something similar to the original Constitution with limited government and individual freedom and sound money, you know, that's when it gets interesting. But right now, you know, we can say all this stuff, nobody listens.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Nobody's listening too much. And people are, this is why the division, because of the idea of what government is supposed to be. Yeah, it's almost like, you know, like on a personal level, a lot of times people who have issues have to, you know, have to fall upon hard times before they recognize that they need to change and look at things. They're forced to look at things differently, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. John, a couple of other topics in your piece, World War III and the military-industrial complex. Maybe you'd comment on that, because Trump likes to brag about how he has really built up the military again. On the other hand, he hasn't started any new wars, which is pretty good for 4 years.
Yeah, to his credit. And you know, that to me is by far the biggest thing that the federal government does, because I have two draft-age sons. And,
sure.
You know, it is crucial that they don't get sent over to some, you know, Middle Eastern hellhole thing that where, you know, it's a pointless fight, but they still might lose their legs. Or, you know, I just hate the prospect and don't want to see it. And, you know, Trump, I'm grateful that he has not started any new wars. But, you know, it's completely conceivable that within weeks we could be fighting China in the South China Sea or Iran in the Middle East. And, you know, that could happen under Trump, or it could happen under Democrats. Except I think the Democrats would probably choose Russia as their World War III opponent.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas we might choose, or the Republicans might choose China. Either way, there, you know, weapons will be employed that don't even belong on planets. You know, we've got so much power right now that the things we can do are just horrifying to think of. But, you know, it's not clear to me that one side or the other is going to make friends better, you know, than turn enemies into friends. Because right now we're just kind of antagonizing the whole world. And, but, you know, Trump, you're right, does deserve credit for the Middle Eastern peace deals he's been able to cut and for the fact that we have not started any big new wars. So, I think if there's anything that we can say that the Trump has done better than the Democrats, that would be it, I think, because, you know, we really have not started anything big and new. And you know, we haven't been able to say that for, what, 30 years now, right?
No.
In most of our adult lives, every 5 or 6 years, we start some new big fight somewhere in the world.
Well, 5 or 6, if Trump is reelected. That's a big one to me as well. And I think Eisenhower was so concerned about it. But, John, I think that, you know, we talk about the deep state. What is the deep state is this huge amount, this military-industrial complex that Eisenhower was very concerned about. And, you know, my friend Jeff Deist, who was Ron Paul's chief of staff during Ron's run for the presidency the last time, he talks about each of these big departments, you know, federal departments, are so big and powerful. They have so much, there's more power than the president has, essentially, each one of them in some ways. And the money that's involved in these, I mean, just think about how Washington keeps getting bigger. All around Washington and the D.C. complex keeps moving and expanding outwardly. And those states that used to be conservative are turning blue. They're turning blue because anybody that gets their money through the government wants to see that continue and get bigger, right? It seems like it.
Oh, yeah. You know, I used to live in Virginia. And it was a conservative state.
Very conservative.
There was no chance of them going for a Democrat presidential nominee.
I remember.
And now, because of Northern Virginia, which is, you know, that's all full of government employees, so they tend to vote liberal because that's, you know, that idea, they have the idea that that's going to funnel more money into their neighborhoods and the departments of the government that they work for. Mm-hmm. So suddenly Virginia is a blue state, which is just amazing, you know, but that's how it works. You know, the government is just expanding. And this is happening under Trump.
Oh, yeah.
He did not cut the size of the government.
Well, so, I mean, we're seeing Trump just not concerned at all about however many trillions it takes, just throw the money out there. And this is what you were saying, that at some point in time when we're forced to think seriously about money, this thing is going to come to an end, and that's You know, that's it. I mean, a lot of these things that you talked about sort of overlap. For example, rampant corruption is another topic that you mentioned. It seems to me that that could overlap with all these other government expenditures too, because as you just said, people vote their pocketbook. And if the government can you know, expand their programs, and they can, you know, if you're sitting in a corporate setting that depends on government spending, you know, you like to see everybody doing well in that corporation, so you're just all in favor of it. So it's like not something that people necessarily consciously engage in. They're probably convincing themselves that these military weapons that they're producing is good in defending America. So there's always that.
I mean, there's always a rationale for the growth of government. But by definition, the bigger government gets, the more corrupt it gets. Because if it has a lot of goodies to hand out, people will find a way to game the system to get those goodies.
Well, this is the issue then in terms of the goodies. And the goodies have been available because of the United States' power, its military-industrial complex, its ability to force other countries to use the dollar as our currency went off the gold standard. The petrodollar came into being. And so this gravy train has been able to go for a long time. But I don't know. At zero interest rates, John, how many foreign countries are going to want to really be buying treasuries, you know? I mean, I don't know. Do you see some risk for the dollar ahead of us perhaps because of this? We have negative real rates now. Nominal rates could be coming.
Yeah. Well, they will have to, because in the next crisis, whatever it is, you know, if the economy doesn't speed up after the coronavirus, or the coronavirus doesn't go away sufficiently, or we have the next war or the next stock market crash, any of those things will force the Fed to act. And it's really got a limited set of tools right now, right? It can create a huge amount of new currency and buy a bunch of bonds, but it's already bought most of the bonds, you know? It was buying junk bonds just recently, and it'll have to buy equities and it will have to push interest rates down dramatically. And so, yeah, all of this stuff is still happening. And you reach a point where you've bailed out everybody in sight, and you've shifted the pressure away from, for instance, Illinois' pensions, which are bankrupt and will have to be bailed out soon, over to the currency. You know, people start to realize that, oh my God, my house price is going up dramatically, and I tried to buy a used car and it was 50% more than I thought it was. And, you know, things are going up in price, which is the same thing as saying the currency is going down in value. And then you get the Austrian economics crack-up boom, right? When people bail on the currency. And then the government has no more tools with which to manipulate these markets and to encourage us all to take on more and more debt. And the system breaks down. And, you know, my point with this article is that that's what we're headed for. And that's when you get, you know, all the stuff that we're worried about now, like a dictatorship. Because when the system spins out of control, historically, I mean, this has happened many times in the past, and governments always act irrationally when they panic. And that's when you get people desperate for strong leadership and governments who just want to stop the bleeding somehow, even if they ignore the Constitution to do it. And so that's when the potential for dictatorship becomes real, not after this election when people are worried that Trump's not going to, you know, accept the vote or anything like that.
Yeah.
But in the next crisis, it's completely possible that we get martial law that's very open-ended, where the government just suspends civil liberties until the crisis is over, and the crisis doesn't end for a long time, and that's basically it for, you know, American democracy. And that's what you get when you screw up your finances. So this is a huge deal. This isn't just, oh, you know, we'll have a couple of weeks of inflation and we'll make some money in the gold market No, this is going to be much bigger and much more protracted.
Although we will
make lots of money in gold if this happens. You know, that's
upside. What you'll do is keep some wealth. I think that's better put. Is you'll keep some wealth if the government allows you to keep your gold. That's another issue, of course, too. But and you know, it was taken away, or it was required to turn it in under Roosevelt. So there's a precedent for that. Well, John, I'd just like to tell our listeners you also had some interesting comments on the environment, and solar is really picking up. I know that you actually wrote a book, maybe you co-authored a book or you were involved with a book that had to do with the environment. So I know that you're quite interested in that. And you point out that solar is really becoming very efficient and is eating into the to the fossil fuels.
Yeah. Well, my point was the whole Green New Deal thing will be mostly taken care of by the free market as new technologies come along that replace older, dirtier technologies. And solar is really the most interesting one in the energy sector. Oh, electric cars are very interesting, too. You know, battery technology in general is going to make a huge difference. And when a technology's time has come, it doesn't matter what the economy is doing. It doesn't matter what the political system thinks. The private sector takes care of it. And that's where it is with solar now. Solar has gotten cheaper year after year after year to the point where it has crossed the line of, for instance, coal-generated electricity. Yeah. It is now cheaper than that in more and more places. So people are just buying it. And so it will replace a lot of fossil fuels, which will go a long way towards goal.
We're going to have to leave it go at that, John. It's fascinating stuff. People, you need to go to dollarcollapse.com. You can read John's article and more than we were able to get to today. Thanks so much for being with us, John, and we'll look to do it again sometime in the near future, hopefully.
Thanks, Jay. I'd like that.
All right, folks. Well, next week, Frank Holmes, Michael Oliver, and Jim Gregg of Benchmark Metals will be with me. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Benchmark Metals is an advanced gold-silver exploration company that is rapidly advancing its Canadian gold-silver project to a production decision. Benchmark is nearing completion of its largest program to date, with up to 100,000 meters of resource expansion and definition drilling in 2020. The multi-million ounce potential project is expected to have a new mineral resource estimate and PEA study completed in 2021. The company is backed by the Metals Group management team and believes this aggressive program will be complemented by one of the strongest commodity bull markets in decades. Visit benchmarkmetals.com and subscribe to follow their success.